On either side the river lie long fields of barley and of rye that clothe the world and meet the sky. And through the field the road runs by to many tired Camelot.
You're listening to the voice of Peggy Ashcroft reading Tennyson's The Lady of Shalott, a page from this week's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Each week at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the Poetry Center of the Young Men and Young Women's Hebrew Association in New York, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets, past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. This week, the old and the new, the classic poetry of England, the modern poetry of America. Our guests, by transcription, Sir John Gielgud, Miss Peggy Ashcroft, and Dr. Johann Egelsrud.
Break, break, break on thy cold gray stones, O sea. And I would that my tongue could utter the thoughts that arise in me. Oh, well for the fisherman's boy that he shouts with his sister at play. Oh, well for the sailor lad that he sings in his boat on the bay. And the stately ships go on to their haven under the hill. But oh, for the touch of a vanished hand and the sound of a voice that is still. Break, break, break at the foot of thy crags, O sea. That the tender grace of a day that is dead will never come back to me.
Among the names of poets which appear constantly in our mail is that of Alfred Lord Tennyson, introduced this week by Sir John Gielgud's reading of Break, Break, Break. Unlike most poets, Tennyson was reared in comfort and died in the peerage. One of 12 children, he was born August 6, 1809, at Somersby in Lincolnshire, and the rolling green countryside surrounding his family home is continually reflected in his work. Tennyson composed his first verse when he was 8. At the age of 10, he wrote hundreds of lines in imitation of Pope, and at 12, even dared an analysis of Milton's Samson Agonistes. At 18, just before entering Trinity College at Cambridge, he collaborated with his brother Charles on his first published volume, Poems by Two Brothers. Tennyson holds a position of high honor in the American schoolroom since the majority of his poems have such a popular appeal to students. Given a memory assignment, they will invariably choose Crossing the Bar, or perhaps you learned Tennyson's Ring Out, Wild Bells. Ring out, wild bells, to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out, wild bells, and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring, happy bells, across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind. For those that here we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right, ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease, ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old, ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land, ring in the Christ that is to be. You might like to save a few of those sentiments for New Year's Eve. They're of much more value than the usual banal toasts. Our second guest to read from the works of Tennyson this week is the very attractive and talented English actress, Miss Peggy Ashcroft. Here again we have a poem which is a favorite in the classrooms, especially among the gentler sex, who are apt to finish this particular narrative with the misty eye and trembling lip. From Tennyson's published collection of poems written when he was 23 years old, Peggy Ashcroft reads The Lady of Shalott.
On either side the river lie long fields of barley and of rye, that clothe the world and meet the sky, and through the field the road runs by to many tired Camelot. And up and down the people go, gazing where the lilies blow, round an island there below, the island of Shalott. Willows whiten, aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver through the wave that runs forever by the island and the river, flowing down to Camelot. Four grey walls and four grey towers overlook a space of flowers, and the silent isle embowers the Lady of Shalott. By the margin willow-veiled slide the heavy barges trailed by slow horses, and unhailed the shallop-flitted silken-sailed skimming down to Camelot. But who hath seen her wave her hand, or at the casement seen her stand? Or is she known in all the land, the Lady of Shalott? Only reapers, reaping early in among the bearded barley, hear a song that echoes cheerly from the river winding clearly down to tired Camelot. And by the moon the reaper weary, piling sheaves in uplands airy, listening, whispers, 'Tis the fairy Lady of Shalott. There she weaves by night and day a magic web with colors gay. She has heard a whisper say a curse is on her if she stay to look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, and so she weaveth steadily, and little other care hath she, the Lady of Shalott. And moving through a mirror clear that hangs before her all the year, shadows of the world appear. There she sees the highway near, winding down to Camelot. There the river eddy whirls, and there the surly village churls, and the red cloaks of market girls pass onward from Shalott. Sometimes a troop of damsels glad, an abbot on an ambling pad, sometimes a curly shepherd lad, or long-haired page in crimson clad, goes by to tired Camelot. And sometimes, through the mirror blue, the knights come riding two and two. She hath no loyal knight and true, the Lady of Shalott. A bow shot from her bower eaves, he rode between the barley sheaves. The sun came dazzling through the leaves, and flamed upon the brazen greaves of bold Sir Lancelot. A red cross knight forever kneeled to a lady in his shield that sparkled on the yellow field beside remote Shalott. The jenny bridle glittered free, like to some branch of stars we see hung in the golden galaxy. The bridal bells rang merrily as he rode down to Camelot, and from his blazoned baldric slung a mighty silver bugle hung, and as he rode his armor rung beside remote Shalott. His broad clear brow in sunlight glowed, on burnished hooves his warhorse strode, from underneath his helmet flowed his coal-black curls, as on he rode, as he rode down to Camelot. From the bank and from the river, he flashed into the crystal mirror. Tirra-lirra, by the river sang Sir Lancelot. She left the web, she left the loom, she made 3 paces through the room, She saw the water lily bloom. She saw the helmet and the plume. She looked down to Camelot. Out flew the web and floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. The curse is come upon me, cried the Lady of Shalott. In the stormy east wind straining, the pale yellow woods were waning, the broad stream in his banks complaining, heavily the low sky raining over towered Camelot. Down she came and found a boat beneath a willow left afloat, and round about the prow she wrote, the Lady of Shalott. And down the river's dim expanse, like some bold seer in a trance, seeing all his own mischance, with a glassy countenance did she look to Camelot. And at the closing of the day, she loosed the chain, and down she lay. The broad stream bore her far away, the Lady of Shalott, lying robed in snowy white, that loosely flew to left and right, the leaves upon her falling light. Through the shadows of the night, she floated down to Camelot. And as the boat head wound along the willowy hills and fields among, they heard her singing her last song, the Lady of Shalott. Heard a carol, mournful, holy, chanted loudly, chanted lowly, till her blood was frozen slowly, and her eyes were dark and holy, turned to towered Camelot. For ere she reached upon the tide, the first house by the waterside, singing, in her song she died, the Lady of Shalott. Under tower and balcony, by garden wall and gallery, a gleaming shape she floated by, dead pale between the houses high, silent into Camelot. And out upon the wharfs they came, knight and burgher, lord and dame, and round the prow they read her name, the Lady of Shalott. Who is this, and what is here? And in the lighted palace near died the sound of royal cheer, and they crossed themselves for fear, all the knights at Camelot. But Lancelot mused a little space. He said, she has a lovely face. God in his mercy lend her grace, the Lady of Shalott.
We had a very good reason for choosing to talk about Lord Tennyson and schoolrooms on this week's edition of Anthology, since our second guest is a poet who is also a teacher. His name is Johann Egelsrud. As a poet, he is currently represented by his volume of poems, My Thinking Heart, published by Vantage Press. As a teacher, he's professor of comparative literature at Finch College in New York. Dr. Egelsrud was born in Tromsø, Norway. He received his B.A. and M.A. degrees from the University of Minnesota and his Ph.D. in comparative literature from the Sorbonne. If you don't mind, Dr. Egelsrud, I'd like to take the role of one of your students. In fact, I'll be much safer in that capacity, since I know so very little concerning the poet who is a teacher. In fact, nothing at all. Could you tell us some of your views on that subject?
Well, teaching poetry in the modern way is quite different from the earlier kind of teaching, in that we do not approach it as a subject that you're supposed to learn something about factually. That is scanning and how many lines in a sonnet and that kind of memory work, which was prevalent for a long time. Instead, I approach the teaching of poetry from the creative point of view. That is, to try to condition the student to understand that a poem is a living thing. Mm-hmm. It's an organic, an organism, which has an inherent life of its own. And that the significant thing about a poem is your own unfolding of that life which is inherent in the poem itself. So that the teaching actually of the technique, for instance, and of the various forms of poetry comes in simply as a means of understanding the expression and why that form happens to convey this meaning, which is the significant thing about the poem.
You're also a musician and a painter, I believe.
Dr. Eggleswoman?
Yes, I have done some of that, indeed.
Would you say that poetry is like music and like a painting in... I mean, your approach to it in teaching it now is more like the appreciation also of music and of a painting rather than the old way of memorization and taking it line by line and pounding this line into your head, you know, and then
yes.
the other line, and
uh-huh.
and finally you've got it or else.
That's very true. It is because what poetry really communicates is not the factual things. It's not the things of the objective world. But it is that something which emerges out of the suggestions that are given by the poet and which you, the reader, supply as a psychological reaction.
In other words, there's a communication between the reader and the poet.
Yes.
And you feel that it's very important that the reader should actually know what the poet was intending to say rather than the reader, say, who picks up a poem and says, well, I don't know what the poet meant, but it means this to me, and I like it that way, and that's it. In other words, you should find what the poet was trying to say.
Yes, I think that is the main thing that I'm trying to do in teaching poetry. It's to get these students to know how to release the inner life of the poem itself.
And that's
why I speak about it from the point of view of the creator, of the writer of poetry, who knows exactly that what he's trying to communicate is an inner meaning which goes beyond any of the factual things that he brings into it. It's almost like music in that respect. As a matter of fact, it's very close to music, in that a melody, for instance, or a musical phrase is not a thing that you can describe or that appeals to anything but the intuitive sense of the unfoldment, the dynamic unfoldment of that phrase. And so in the same way, a poem has that kind of organic life that you must unfold. And it's in the unfoldment of the whole thing, including both the rhythm and the melody of the language itself, and these suggestions of meaning which you then create the reactions, which are the significant meaning of the poem itself.
We've talked about the two professions of poetry, or being a poet, rather, and being a teacher. Now, when we had Dr. William Carlos Williams, for instance, on the program, we asked him professional advice for young poets and so on. So maybe we could ask you not only professional advice, but how you feel that the two professions work out together. Is there a clash between the poet and the teacher?
No, I don't feel that it is, because a poet has the urgent desire, of course, to communicate that which is deeply significant to him. And so in that way, since the approach to teaching now is from the creative point of view, I feel that it is simply another opportunity to communicate directly to young people these values which are so significant to me.
Well, let's fall under the spell of your urge, shall we, to communicate with the poetry you have written by reading some of it to us from... This is all from My Thinking Heart, right? From
yes.
your book.
The first poem that I want to read is called The Creator, and I thought it would be fitting because that is an attempt at explaining or giving an expression of that quality which is the mind moving on a plane which is freed from all the restrictions and all the hampering qualities of life in general, and therefore projects itself and creates a world of its own in which you are the master, so to say. And that is what I mean when I say that the poem seems to me to be a little universe, a little world, a little organism which has its own inherent life. And so this creator, I think, expresses this sense. O troubled mortal that I am, bound by insidious unseen laws, hounded by logic in my brain, and sore enslaved by body drives and lust, I stumble, cursing gravitation's star-born force. This seed, predestined to produce an other tree, mocks with its pattern that repeats my sensate ego's freedom and its pride. Your face, your hair, your lips, through passionate response in me, taunt my better judgment and my mind. O world-defying being in my heart, eternal rebel, rise and smite with sharp confusion all this sense. From this too cunning prison, where you meet at every turn the chilling chains, plot your escape, and from within, raise the wild ladder of your dreams. Break through the bars of reason by your art. Destroy the locks of logic, and force with magic the shackles of the bound event. Achieve, O willful, proud creator, through chaos, your own free world. I'll read another poem that I think also has some of that search for meanings which are not said directly by the poet, but in this case, it is the feeling of identity, that in all the change that is about us, our bodies are deteriorating, changing, our surroundings, everything is changing, and yet there is this spiritual sense of identity which remains, and that I'm trying to communicate through this poem. The poem is called No Matter How I Turn This Mirror. Although I turn this mirror upside down, my image moves not, but remains intact. My leg, when plunged into a lucid stream, looks broken, yet is unchanged in fact. And heaven's vital light, that well may seem to speed so lustrously across my days, in truth I know does never move at all. Eternal change reflects then countless ways here within the tranquil pool my soul. Yet, from my multi-shed of deep recess, beneath the burning clouds I must confess, no matter how I turn this mirror's frame, my image in it still remains the same. The next poem is also about these questions that move the more or less thinking heart. That is, it's the attempt at expressing a feeling of the indifference of nature to human values. It's called A Sound Reaching No Ear. The green, cold sea I saw wash over scattered wreckage on Iwo Jima's tragic shores, rocking smashed tanks like death's cradles, rolling a splintered cannon like a broken cross, billowing gun fragments, pierced helmets, and torn shirts. That green, cold sea, O heart, is the everlasting insensate, the final absolute, against whose relentless motion your bitter cry is futile as sound, reaching no ear. The next poem is about, again, that feeling which has always been very close to me, the sense of what is the ultimate meaning and what is the ultimate truth? And with the modern scientific understanding of matter as being a form of energy, vitality, life, then comes the feeling that your own being is a part of this. And so that is what I try to convey in terms that would make the reader sense this mystery of life itself. It's called Ultimate Reality. Watching the surgeon's swift incision, the ribs parted, the living heart laid bare, I shudder. For what I see there, pounding that fibrous wall, knocking with quick, insistent beats, is the unfathomable presence, the mystic entity, the ultimate reality. The next poem that I'd like to read is one that has some literary reference, at least, and therefore might lend itself to reading of this kind. It's called To the Friar Beaten by Chaucer. Out of the dense obscurity of countless dead and nameless men, you, friar, picked by chance to live, only because learned Dan Chaucer came briskly down Fleet Street late one day, mad in his heart from having seen corruption among the lawyers at the temple. You, friar, quite drunk, and filled with extravagant and alcoholic zeal, felt he should be saved for Christ. After blocking his way, arguing, pulling at his sleeve, and getting furious at being pushed away, you struck him. And finally brought down on your tonsured head his hard-knuckled, nervous fist until you, in the pent-up fury of his rage, sent you bleeding and howling in the gutter. Then, the apprehension for violation of the gravity and peace, the fine. Strange destiny. You did not know that hitting Chaucer, you struck at fate, and that since then you live, remembered as a moment in the life of him who men will not forget.
Dr. Johann Egelsrud, poet, musician, painter, teacher. You can find his latest book on sale now, My Thinking Heart, published by Vantage Press. Thank you very much, Dr. Egelsrud, for a very pleasant visit. Please come back and read for us again on Anthology. Next week, Anthology 1954, a radio review of our first year of broadcasting, highlighting many of the anthology programs which you've enjoyed. Among the poets you'll hear are Ogden Nash, Carl Sandburg, Marianne Moore, Edna St. Vincent Millay, and Dame Edith Sitwell. Our guest readers will be Sir Laurence Olivier, Agnes Moorehead, Noel Coward, and many more. Be sure to listen next week to Anthology 1954. Anthology comes to you transcribed in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA in New York. This has been an NBC radio production, written and directed by Draper Lewis. Until next week, this is Fleetwood wishing you good luck and good reading.